Hello and welcome along to the RTE Rugby Podcast, and a packed podcast this week. Bernard Jackman is with me right now for a URC and Champions Cup talking points of the week. Hannah O'Connor will be on the line later to recap a great weekend for Ireland in the Women's Six Nations, and I'll also be joined by Munster and Ireland out half, Jack Crowley. I wonder if there's anything interesting we can talk to him about. Anyway, since we have so much to get through, let's not waste any time. Bernard, we were both in Castlebar on Saturday. I might just start the pod with talking about the occasion itself. A great occasion all round at McHale Park. Super venue. The crowd turned out in numbers and turned out early as well. It was really heartening to see how many of them were in on the terraces, trying to get obviously the best spot on the terrace so early in the afternoon, when it was a pretty miserable early afternoon in Mayo weather-wise. I'd say if you were selling ponchos out there on outside the ground on Saturday morning or early Saturday afternoon, you were going to make a fine coin. But it was, they didn't get the result they wanted, obviously, but it was a great finish to be worthy of the occasion.
Yeah, I think that was the majority of the fans there were Connacht fans, to be fair. Like, I think a lot of Munster fans obviously are going to be in La Rochelle this weekend. But it was a very Connacht dominated crowd. And yeah, we were in the press area when they opened the gates, and trolls of people coming into that open side of the ground. And it was raining at the time, and people were just happy to sit there for 2 hours and take it all in. I thought it was an amazing atmosphere. Unfortunately, for Connacht, Munster played the perfect game plan to kind of kill any hope Connacht had, I thought, quite early. Obviously, the red card would have given Connacht fans a bit more hope, but I just thought Munster were so accurate in how they played, executed any opportunity, took full advantage of any opportunities for points that were presented to them, and just snuffed out Connacht's attack in a way that I think Den Sleamy would be really happy with, because there has been some bad days from defensively, and I thought to look much better organised, much better focus, and forced a lot of errors out of Connacht, which their set piece took advantage of. So even at set piece, their defensive lineup was key to winning the game. Not just the one at the end, which was obviously the high profile one, but throughout the match they stole ball, they messed up delivery. So very good performance by Munster. Their halfbacks Casey and Crowley were excellent, and yeah, I think Connacht lost an opportunity by not winning to really give those fans, send them all happy. But I also think the nature of the last 15 minutes, the fight back, and some of the rugby that started to play then, particularly down to when Munster were down to 13, hopefully get people a taste of it and they'll go to the sports ground, or they'll go follow Connacht on the road, or if Connacht move a game in the future, they'll come back. So yeah, not all lost for Connacht, but a very disappointing Connacht season for Connacht and the Interpros to not win Interpro for the first time since 2013-2014 season is a bad season for them.
The one disappointing part I had for the from the occasion, just from a personal point of view, was you were over in the commentary position on the far side of the ground, so I'm not sure what it was like over there. But obviously the press box that we would have been in, it was behind glass, so we could kind of completely lost the atmosphere, which looked fantastic. You could just, like, in the bigger moments, you could obviously just about pick up the crowd noise. But there were a couple of occasions, particularly in that last 10 minutes or so, where I was thinking, God, I'd actually just love to be standing outside the door there and just get a feel for what it is. Because there was great colour around. It looked a brilliant atmosphere. But we were kind of sitting in silence. We actually had a couple of rows beside us. We had Donald Sullivan and Barry Murphy were doing live commentary for Limerick's Live 95 FM. And I heard him at one point kind of, his voice caught my ear, and he said he was remarking on being in this little quiet box, and said it was like commentating on a rugby match from the Crucible or something like that.
Yeah, and we would have been soundproof only for, I opened the side window, and that was, we were on the side where the referee used to have to go to the big screen. It was funny hearing some of the comments from the crowd when he was going through the process and looking for foul play, because there was obviously three incidents where he went to it, the Bundiaki crocodile roll, the scandal flip on Bundiaki at the ruck, and obviously the red card. But I think on the third time, I could hear, it's not F and GA ref, you know what I mean? It's rugby, let them hit each other, was some of the comments. But I imagine, I'd say for, like, and speaking to someone on the way out, like, it was quite novel for them to have a referee explain the reasoning, and obviously have access to a video replay as well. And my feeling from speaking to people was that a lot of GA people thought that was great, that they were informed at least what was happening to a better level. So yeah, it was plenty of spark in it. But I walked across then to the press area to do a piece for the Sindo, and I walked through the Munster and Connacht players as they were kind of clapping each other off, and there was a real sense of job done by Munster. You know, I think that result could be a result at the end of the season. They talk about that their season started to turn around, you know, in a positive manner. And they're used to peaking at the end. Over the last couple of years, they've been much better at the end of the season than they have at the start. So it could be a big result for them on the road.
Yeah, and let's carry on with that point then, because the narrative of the La Rochelle game has kind of flipped in bit by a small bit. It's kind of crept along over the last few weeks with La Rochelle's poor form, but I think the fact that Munster went about their game so well and so smartly on Saturday has really changed the way this match in France at the weekend is being viewed. Because I know it got a bit hairy for Munster in the last 10 minutes, but with the guts of 70 minutes played, considering they'd played since the 25th minute with 14 players, and they had just survived, brilliantly survived Tadhg Burns' yellow card, a 10-minute period where we were down to 13, and where they managed that so well. So for that first 70 minutes, I was sitting beside I won't specifically name the colleague, but we turned to each other with about 10 minutes to go, and we both said, like, I'm just double checking it. This is the best Munster have played this season, isn't it? And it felt like that.
To be honest, Neil, it was the best game management I think Munster have put in place all season. And, you know, they played a lot off Craig Casey, you know, and he was brilliant at that meter. You're not out tackling the 9 meter around the ruck, and he really exploited that, just getting out. He had options inside, outside. The ball wasn't in there for long, so it was very hard for Connor to get off the line and make impact tackles. Munster's quality of carry and clean was just really excellent. They blew away the potential jacklers, you know, nearly every time, had quick ball, but they didn't then play really fast all the time. You know, they were just very exact and precise in terms of how they wanted to manipulate Connacht. And then whenever they felt they'd lost momentum, they were very happy to go to the kicking game, but it kicked well and kicked with variety in terms of whether high, long, on the ground, but also probably wanted to exploit Connacht's vulnerability in the backfield in terms of the aerial. But also Connacht's lack of a kicking game, which bar that long 50-22 from Mac Hansen, I haven't seen the exact stats, but I would say the kick meterage was definitely dominated by Munster. So all in all, Mike Prendergast and Costello and Leamy and Cronin and everyone helping out with the team at the moment, they definitely would be got home feeling that they put together the smartest game plan. And to be honest, this weekend in La Rochelle, they're going to have to play smart. I think if they try and outpower or outplay La Rochelle, they're probably only be one winner. But if they can be as accurate as they were at the weekend, they maybe can exploit a team whose confidence must be a little bit shot.
One of the good points you made there was they didn't always play fast, but when they played slow, it looked like they played slow deliberately. And
100%.
so much of what they were doing was by design. And that was led, obviously, by Casey and Crowley, as you mentioned as well. But it was just so well managed how they kicked, playing differently with and against the wind as well. Because, and I'm sure people who just watched it on TV could get a sense of how windy it was. Because one of those TV camera angles, you could see the camera was actually struggling to kind of hold itself straight under the strain of the wind. But then there was the lovely bits of attack as well, not just the boring stuff. There was the highlight catching things where Jack Crowley's delayed pass for Calvin Nash's try, Craig Casey's support line, or for Case try, Casey's support lines all day then as well. And that bullet pass he threw for Crowley. Obviously, it's not a pass he's going to be throwing if he doesn't have penalty advantage, but just absolutely darted that, skipped three players and puts Crowley in. In terms of like halfback game management, it was perfectly done.
Yeah, and I think we know that Craig can play fast. I think that was the most pleasing thing for me was he was able to mix them up at the right time. And again, when you're up in a press box or in a commentary area,
you get a really good feel. The Nines are obviously always on the ball, or going towards the ball, whereas with Crowley, you could see him organising people out of screen, you know, and just looked very comfortable. I thought it was, it probably worked really well that he probably didn't go and play in Edinburgh or in Glasgow, or no, in Edinburgh last weekend. That he had that weekend off to just come back. And obviously he hadn't played a huge amount of Six Nations, so I wasn't sure which would work best for him. But it was pretty clear that since he came in Monday, he was back in control. And he set the team up brilliantly around him, which is what you want. So, it's a big win for them. Munster are now very much in control of their own destiny. And it's also an away win in a hostile environment, which their away form has been a bit patchy. So I think it couldn't have come at a better time for Munster.
I won't dwell on the Nankivell red card, just because the decision is, you know, the appeal is happening today. You could well have an answer by the time this podcast goes out. So I think us rehashing it probably won't do much benefit. I know you thought it was a little bit harsh at the time. I was probably leaning a little bit more towards red. But to move the conversation on, how do Munster's chances against La Rochelle hinge on Alex Nankivell being available or unavailable?
I think he'd be a massive blow to lose him, to be fair. I think he's someone, when you're in a dressing room, whether it's in Toma Park or in La Rochelle, and you're going out to battle against a quality side, you know he's going to turn up. I think that's the biggest thing. And I'm not knocking what he brings, because he brings a lot. But I think one of the big things, I think, when I think of Nankivell, is consistency, you know, and aggression, and a type of player who you want to play with. And he will be a big blow, particularly it's going to be hostile down there. I know Munster fans have done an incredible job trying to get tickets, but this place, it was a fortress, obviously, the last few months. That's changed. But I think Europe and their memories of Europe, and the fact that it's Munster, will bring out the best of this La Rochelle team and fans. And having someone like Nankivell, who's your defensive leader, who gives you a bit of steel, having him there would be a huge boost to them, and having him unavailable would be a blow for sure.
As we kind of said, the narrative of the game has flipped considerably in the last few weeks. And we obviously haven't mentioned the Rog factor as well, which just ramps up the conversation around it so much as well. I know Munster and Rog have crossed paths since his retirement when he was at Racing as an assistant coach, but it obviously is much different when he's head coach against them now. It's the first time that would have happened. First time these two teams have played each other, never mind even in the Champions Cup. That's a rarity for Munster to come across new opposition as well. But there is just we were obviously critical about the pool stages of this competition, lacking jeopardy, just not being the same as it was. But this is Champions Cup rugby now. This is what we've all been looking forward to.
Straight away stood out to be the most fascinating draw of the last 16 because of the Rog Munster history, because of what he's obviously built in La Rochelle. I think the beauty of Rog's activity in the media is we do hear a lot from him and his opinion. He's always very honest, and he's very insightful. But probably the challenge for him now is he's had to comment on Munster a lot over the last couple of years. And even the Jack Crowley being left out for Ireland, you know, he had to comment on that. And that will have certainly been listened to and taken note of by Munster, because that's just natural. You know, it's natural when one of your favourite sons is making comments about you. And whether they're right or wrong, doesn't matter. It's when you get a chance to play them, then it's in the back of your mind. Play each other, it's in the back of your mind. And that makes it even more fascinating. But the reality is, what Rog said in the media is going to have very little impact on the game. If La Rochelle can get back to their best, they should win. That's the reality of it. And that's his biggest focus this week, is trying to find out what the right key to them is. And he has to hope that team isn't just over the hill, you know, that there's another belt in them. And I think you can't say being at home is going to be the answer, because they've been at home and haven't performed, drawn and lost. over the last while. But they are the internationals back again, another week with them back after Six Nations. They are in a big trouble in the top 14, but this is a competition they've won twice and got to a final. And they have very fond memories of it. And I think that and the occasion and it being Munster, and it's obviously their best chance of silverware, you'd say, at this moment for this season, and their team who have won trophies together, that this may be this may get the best back out of them, because I don't think they've gone from being good, well coached to poorly coached. Mm-hmm. There's probably very little difference in terms of what they're trying to do, but for whatever reason, their confidence has been stalled. Obviously, he's trying to rebuild the squad for next year, and that can cause conflict, and that can cause a drop off in performance, etc. But normally, with these really good teams, which La Rochelle are, they can find a way again if the challenge in front of them is big enough and exciting enough, and I think it is this weekend. So I would imagine La Rochelle would be back to somewhere close to their best or heading towards it. So Munster will have to nearly put together another perfect performance, I think, to beat them, because the fear is that size and power game that La Rochelle can bring when they're on firing on all cylinders, that'd be hard for Munster to stop. They looked really physical against Connacht, but we have to take into account that Connacht aren't a physical side. You know, they don't have the density, they don't have the power of the Antonios, of the Aldreets, of the Bodies, etc., of the Skeletons. So this will be another step up. But from a Munster point of view, they're going there on the back of a very good performance. And for them, it's Europe. And regardless of the fact they haven't won it since 2008, they have often pulled out performances in Europe, which has got no correlation to what they looked like the week before or the week before that. So I can't wait for this game.
Yeah, it's going to be brilliant. For Connacht then, Challenge Cup action this week against Cardiff on Saturday. Last week though, kind of just story of the season really. They've scored 102 points in their last three games. They've only won one of them. And they still have to go to South Africa. They're down in 13th place in the table. I know there isn't a huge amount, there's only 4 points between themselves in 13th, and I'm looking at Bennett on up in sixth, or Munster up in, or Ulster, sorry, up in sixth place. So there isn't a massive gap there, but they do have a tough run of fixtures. In terms of Challenge Cup, are they contenders?
I think they believe they are. At the moment, I struggle to see it, to be honest. I know they've got a good draw. And Cardiff is very winnable, for sure. My fear to try and target a Challenge Cup now isn't like it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Some of these French clubs will take it seriously from the quarterfinals on, and that's where I feel, unless Connacht can stop hemorrhaging tries and points, it's very hard to see them outrun some of those better teams, because they're just giving up too many points. Can they win it? Absolutely. I think with the fact they have to go to South Africa, it's the only show in town for them now. So they won't be fighting on two fronts like most other teams will be. But again, their defense, if you look at that try for Craig Casey, it was from a line-out starter play. It was all really nice by Munster. There was loads of deception. There was loads of detail in it. The lines of running were perfect. But at the end of the day, Cordero comes up to hit Nash. Connacht haven't actually bit down. Connacht probably haven't done what Munster hoped they would do with all their decoy lines and all their deception. In fact, they hadn't even created an overlap.
The read was correct.
The read was right. Everything was, if you're a defense coach, you're going, over those phases, we have actually done everything perfectly. And even though he jumped, you still think if Cordero misses that tackle, that there's a safety valve, you know what I mean? But so I it's definitely Cordero's fault. But just the problem for them is when they make a mistake, it's generally fatal, you know, whereas other defensive systems, you make a mistake, someone saves your ass. You make another mistake, someone saves your ass. And you nearly have to make... To be honest with you, you nearly have to make, in a good defensive system, there has to be three system errors or three individual errors for the opposition to score. Whereas in Connacht, when I look at him recently, it's one error try, you know, and that was a missed tackle by Cordero. The read was good, missed tackle by Cordero, and they get him behind. And again, can you win a Challenge Cup without fixing that? I doubt it. I doubt it. Have they ability? Absolutely. Do they have a really good philosophy on how they want to play? Yeah, they do. Is the weather going to get better and their lack of a kicking game is going to be less relevant? Probably. Yet still, if you're giving up that many points, even against the teams who have a man less than you, I struggle to see how they can win it. But I hope they go on a big run and I hope they win it. It'd be brilliant for them. Like, you know, like imagine if they're in a final in Cardiff, how many fans would travel like they did to Edinburgh back for that Pro 14 final. So they have a chance. As I said, I think they're only fighting on one front, but just, you know, it's lack of lots of rumours about things not being great down there, to be fair, as well.
Yeah. Let's follow up on that then as well, because obviously, like, that was going to be my next question. How much of this off-field uncertainty do you think has kind of bled its way down into the performances? So yeah, Pete Wilkins obviously is still on sick leave. There's strong reports that Scott Fardy is going to be leaving at the end of the season. We know Mark Sexton is gone. I know they have Rod Seeb coming in from Australia. Reports now that Billy Millard from Harlequins is going to be coming in as well. There's so much uncertainty around where the playing group and squad are going,
I think Billy Millard will come in. I think he'll be a good addition given his experience of Connacht Rugby because he was there as a coach, of Cardiff, where, to be fair, he would have been running on a reducing budget, and that's, you know, that's tough. Then Harlequins, where, you know, he's obviously had a lot of experience working with quality players and quality coaches in a good league. So I think that would be a really good addition for them. It's just basically what his role is and what's around him. You know what I mean? That's the key, is to get that right. And I think you can see, like, I don't know if you, so I'll give you an example. So Leicester there a couple of weeks ago, Cheka fell out with the defence coach, who apparently was very popular, and he left until the end of the season when Cheka leaves. So you'd say, oh, that's really unsettling. And they went to Northampton and hammered them 32-0. You know, there's certain teams that can maybe handle a little bit of uncertainty in the environment. And normally they're kind of a team that have plenty of experience, you know. So they don't get, they know the job is the job. The job is to perform on Saturday. And then there's other teams where they kind of need that real clarity, real security, real certainty around what's happening off the field. Because off the field affects them, you know, it affects them next year, affects them this season. So, and maybe Connacht are just, maybe the players are struggling a little bit with that lack of certainty, or maybe not. I'm not sure. We don't know that. You can't put a finger on it. But certainly, if you're a Connacht fan, watching Connacht over the last 6, 7, 8 weeks in particular, I think the performances have dropped off a bit. They weren't perfect, you know, probably since Christmas, to be fair, the Ulster game. Since then, I've struggled to have real confidence that they were geared up to make the top eight or to win the Challenge Cup. And Saturday in McHale Park didn't convince me otherwise. Now, I think they'll still get past Cardiff. It's just how that end of the season looks like for them.
Yeah, so if they get past Cardiff, it would be a quarterfinal against either Perpignan or Racing at home again. Home all the way through to the semi-finals if they do get there. Who knows? They might be going back to Castlebar for a big semi-final if they can get there again. Another big big day out, or maybe another larger ground around the province. But we'll wait and see. Let's move on to Leinster. An incredible 10-7 win against the Sharks last week. One of those really, really enjoyable low scoring games that pop up every now and again, where it seems like there's jeopardy almost every second of the match, every mistake that's made. But Harlequins at home in the Champions Cup last 16 this weekend at Croke Park, reports of about 60,000 going to be at that, so another big payday for Leinster. Does the emotional energy that last weekend's win against the Sharks would have had, does that offer energy to the side that's going to be playing this week? Or is it two different teams entirely? Like, we'll say, can all the internationals who weren't obviously in Durban at the weekend, are they going to be able to feed off what happened last weekend? Because it was a real feel-good win.
Oh, 100%, Neil. And like, it was, it looked unlikely when you saw that Leinster were sending back coaches and players, which I totally understand. The beauty of having that buffer is you can do that. But what I loved about this group was they obviously said, right, we're gonna lay down a marker here for the province and ourselves. And I think that's why they celebrated so wildly. You know, we saw celebrations that would be fitting for lifting a trophy, but it doesn't matter. They had done something really difficult, and they did it together, and they did it in a way where they actually didn't attack. They didn't. Their attack was actually really poor. It was just literally defense, and taking opportunity. So, sorry, the try for Scott Penny was a very nice attack, but in general, it was all about rolling up your sleeves and frustrating, hassling Harry and the Sharks into an unbelievable amount of errors. And even their scrum was much better. Deegan changed into channel one earlier and was just gone. You know, the Sharks had a dominance there, but Leinster never let it become an issue like it did at the end against the Bulls. So I thought Healy actually had one of his best games for a long time. He's really powerful on his carry. Obviously, he gave them some leadership up front. And yeah, just the ferocity which they wanted to hit the Sharks, I thought was excellent. I thought John McKee actually had a very, very good game as well. And then the usual suspects, Tommy O'Brien, Charlie Tector, etc. this year. The only worry for Leinster was probably Frawley. I think it's been hard to see him struggle so much. He hasn't obviously had a lot of game time, but he just looks, that New Zealand game and a couple of drop balls in the backfield seem to have dented his confidence. And yeah, you just love to see him get back, obviously, get back to the player he can be. But it's hard to manage that now for Leinster because it's the end of the season and you're getting into more knockout rugby. But the players who were playing for Leinster who weren't down there were playing against Harlequins. They would have been incredibly proud of that, and it would have definitely given them a real sense of responsibility because they know they're going to pick this week. You know, they know that they're getting a shot to play this week against Harlequins on the back of previous form rather than Leinster form, recent Leinster form. And also those lads coming back from South Africa, they'll bounce into the High Performance Centre and they'll be energised this week, and there'll be a real feel-good factor. And it's probably the worst, you know, it's the worst possible opponent for Harlequins because Leinster, not just in this game, but all season, Leinster's defence has been standout. Mm. And you just fear that Harlequins will just come unstuck trying to play a lot of rugby against a team who normally take teams apart who do that.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how much they're able to ride the wave of those results. Like, and I say results in South Africa because picking up a losing bonus point against the Bulls in advance of the game would have been seen as a half-decent outcome. I know they would have been very frustrated not to win it in general, but you just look back at the last couple of seasons and how the way those two tours of South Africa went, where there just seems to be this kind of bad buzz that followed them around for a little while afterwards because they took heavy beatings. But on Harlequins then this weekend, to follow on what you were saying there, it is a sticky game if they don't get it right. We have seen in the past with Leinster where some of the, they haven't always hit the ground running straight after a Six Nations when the players have been well rested.
Yeah, they haven't. I think, to be honest, it's probably been harder for them, Neil, if Ireland have been successful. You know, I'd like to hope that those players have left Six Nations squads feeling a little bit unsatisfied and wanting to finish the season on a high. And I think also, if you look at Leinster's game model, it's not as intricate as it used to be. It shouldn't actually take long to get back in, particularly because they've had that, obviously, extra week prep. And it's quite... it's pretty simple. It's pretty simple. As simple as you can say, as simple as it can be. I'm not saying it's simple. It's beautiful. There's beauty in its simplicity. Mm-hmm. But you still have to go and actually implement it. And there's a huge amount of energy and aggression and application, particularly mental application behind it. But I think they can get back into track quicker now than it would have normal years. And I would expect them to be absolutely bouncing and desperate for silverware, this year with Leinster, which obviously has eluded them the last couple of years.
Yeah, so that's Leinster against Harlequins, 3 p.m. on Saturday afternoon, live on RT2 and RT Player. Winner of that will play against the Glasgow Warriors or Leicester Tigers. On to Ulster then to finish things up. Beat the Stormers 38-34 on Friday night. They're playing Sunday away to Bordeaux. A seismic challenge for them on Sunday afternoon. But on the Stormers game, we said it last week on the podcast that Ulster, they're clinging on, they're picking up their wins, but their games are becoming a little bit too exciting. They turned it up to 11 last Friday night. 17-0 down after 8 minutes. And yet somehow, if they actually had gone and lost the game, it would have been a terrible collapse. At the very least, their matches are highly entertaining to watch.
Absolutely. And when you have Stockdale, Ballacloon, and Larry in that back three, and Jack Murphy's passing game, you're going to get fireworks. And I thought, you know, we know the Stormers are probably the most aggressive blitz defence after Leinster now. And I thought Ulster dealt with that really well, particularly because they weren't afraid to run from very deep, where Stormers aren't as aggressive because obviously they're covering the backfield. And then they were quite good on counter-attack, which is before they actually, Stormers have a chance to get set and have a rook to bring it. So I thought that was excellent. Obviously, unfortunately, Ballacloon seems to have picked up a recurring injury, which obviously hopefully is not too bad, because it was great to see him back. But yeah, I think Richie Murphy would be absolutely delighted with the character they showed. And it was a win, probably didn't look likely on paper, given the fact that Ulster had scraped over the Dragons and the Stormers had looked good against the Scarlets. But I think it was a big win. It was a big win for Ulster. I think the Stormers and the Sharks at the moment are really struggling, but
yeah,
don't take away from that win for Ulster. They had to show, as I said, serious team spirit, mental fortitude, and also no little skill to get it done.
And listen, they're right back in the mix for securing their Champions Cup plays for next season. You mentioned Rob Ballacoon has picked up a hamstring injury where he's getting it checked out to see the extent of it. So fingers crossed he's okay, because it was really heartwarming to see him back out on the pitch after 11 months out last weekend. But Stockdale, though, I really want to talk about Jacob Stockdale, because he was a player that was looking really sharp for the first couple of months of the season, got his chance with Ireland, was playing brilliantly in that game against Fiji, and obviously picked up an injury which kept him out for a little while. But he's been back a few weeks now and he has been playing really, really well again. And I know he was in with the Ireland squad at the tail end of the Six Nations, but I thought on Friday night against the Stormers, he was fantastic again and seems to have changed. Am I right in saying he's changed his game a little bit over the last couple of seasons, where I think maybe the criticism of him 2 years ago was that he was still your old-fashioned winger that was hanging out on the touchline and he was a great finisher and all that, but that wouldn't get you into an Ireland squad under Andy Farrell because he likes the wingers to get involved. It feels like he is getting way more involved and popping up in the middle of the pitch. And you look at Zach Ward's try on Friday night, where Stockdale just hammers at the line and breaks right through. It was terrible defence, obviously, but it was just a brilliant line against the grain up to the 22 and just fires a bullet pass out to Zach Ward. It feels like they're the kind of things that Andy Farrell really, really will look at favourably.
100%. Look at, you know, he's obviously competing with James Lowe, so that's not easy. But I like how he's playing. 100%. I think if he hadn't have evolved, there was no way back to him for Ireland. Just under Farrell, the way he wants his wingers to be busy, and I think it's brilliant to see him popping up in different places, looking for the ball, because when he has the ball, like, good things happen. And I wouldn't write him off coming back and being a big player for Ireland over the next couple of seasons.
Has the potential? He's a player who has a big opportunity in the summer. Yeah. You would reckon?
Yeah, this summer tour for him, is, providing he doesn't pick up any injuries, is a great opportunity for him to go and be on the end of some, you know, that Irish back line again. We know he can score. His finishing ability, to be fair, is he the best finisher in the game, in the Irish game? He probably is, you know, proven. Yeah, like James Lowe gives you a huge amount of other things, and he can finish for sure. But Stockdale can do it different ways. You know, his chip and chase game is exceptional, and we can see from BA Barry and other wingers where that's become even more relevant, because he has that pace. He obviously has the left boot. He obviously has size and power. And yeah, I think Richie will continue to look to bring him in into the game in other areas than the left wing.
You mentioned Louis Bielbery. That's obviously who Ulster are playing this weekend, Bordeaux. How much of a chance have they got of pulling out a shock? Last words.
Look, if they'll be clinging to what they probably saw on Sunday night, Racing against Bordeaux, where Bordeaux looked human, you know. Jalibert was amazing, but Bordeaux's pack were shocking. But I think there'll be a big reaction to that. They have been very consistent this year, and it's a horrible draw on paper, and it could be a horrible draw on grass too. If Bordeaux get their best players into the game and go after Ulster, we've seen how they can rack up a lot of points. And at the moment, with the Pont out, you know, you'd have to say Bordeaux have a genuine chance of winning this this competition if they continue to improve. So yeah, it's a big ask for Ulster. Also, they've nothing to lose either, you know. There's no pressure on. And getting that win in the URC means, regardless of what happens, unless they get absolutely tonked, as you said, they're in a really good position for a European qualification.
Who knows? We might be previewing a Munster Ulster Champions Cup quarter final next week. We'll wait and see. Bernard, thanks a million as always. Loads more coming up on this podcast now. Hannah O'Connor on the Women's Six Nations. First, though, Jack Crowley. Now, I'm delighted to be joined by Munster and Ireland out half and Pinergy Ambassador Jack Crowley. Jack, thanks for speaking. It's just good to see you.
Good to see you too.
I'm gonna jump in with the big question. I presume you've been asked it all day. Did you get down to Musgrave last week for Bandon Grammar's Junior Cup final?
I'm delighted someone asked about it. I didn't. No, I didn't, unfortunately. I was down in Cork, but I was having a few days off, but I was able to watch the live link. My cousin was actually playing, so my family were there in support in our presence. But yeah, unbelievable. First of all, for them to get in, but then to go and win it, I think is really special for the area.
Give your cousin a shout out. What's his name? What's his position? Is he a Crowley as well?
No, he's a Burke, Anna Burke. He was 13.
Right, very good. Well done to him. In all seriousness, no, there has been a lot of discussion around your future, obviously, at the moment. We've heard a lot of different stories. We've heard there's an offer on the table from Leicester. We've had some reports saying you're definitely staying put. We've had others saying nothing is sorted yet. Can you give us an update on where you are at the moment with your future?
At the moment, I have nothing confirmed, no pen to paper on anything. So that's the current situation. You know, with the magnitude of this week, you know, and even the priority of last week, that they always take centrefold, and then obviously as you go on in your career, you learn to compartmentalize, you know, certain decisions like this. And when it comes to on-field stuff, you know, that requires all your attention, and particularly a week like this in Europe requires all my attention. And I'm fortunate that you know, I've got people in the background that are doing that for me, and hopefully we'll come to the best conclusion.
Yeah, and you could see obviously on Saturday you're not looking like a player whose mind is elsewhere. Is it kind of maybe when you're alone in the evenings sitting at home, or, you know, when you have those moments to yourself where the thoughts start to come around about the various considerations of what you need to be thinking about?
I guess as you grow to, first of all, as a person, you start to understand about what's important, and how you organize your day has become massively important to me, and how I prepare, and you just got to start creating little pockets in the day that, you know, not just about this decision, but, you know, about anything, and you know, doing the clothes and drying and whatnot. You know, that you need to have a certain part of the day for everything, and it's equally important to have a part of the day for for thinking to yourself and remove all noise and extraction. So at the moment, yeah, it's learning how to compartmentalize this and keep the main thing, which is performing the pitch, because that's ultimately what gets you into conversations like this and gets opportunities like this put in front of you.
Did you get the chance to chat much with your next head coach, Clayton McMillan, when he was in town last week?
So he came up for a few days from New Zealand, which first of all, lads were, you know, blown away by how, you know, the dedication he did to come over, you know, mid-season. And obviously that shows the confidence as well he has in the playing group down in Chiefs, which is, you know, something that's, I suppose, cool to see. And then secondly, he just gave a brief introduction to the team on the Monday morning and just said he'd be around observing and whatnot. He didn't want to encroach on anything that was being done. And that's the way he went about it. And I guess, yeah, he had a great demeanour about him and you know, gave a great feel to the lads.
How much would the kind of desire to play for Ireland come into the decision you have to make?
Well, I guess, you know, when making a decision, you have to weigh up everything, and you've got to go through with a fine comb. And for me, that's obviously a massive element of you know, a decision like this. And it's one that you've got to understand both sides to it. And for me, it's about weighing up everything, almost living it and what it feels like, and then coming back to your values and principles and the way in which you want to go about things. Everything's weighed up. Everything's got to be weighed up, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The Six Nations then, you obviously had to be patient for your chance at out half in particular, played minutes kind of in the centre and full back at various stages as well. How patient do you have to kind of be during that camp to first of all not be over eager or not be seen to kind of be feeling sorry for yourself if you're not getting selected at various points, but also that when the opportunity does come, whether it's a minute into a match or 79 minutes into the match, that the focus and the mind is purely on that task?
It's massive. You know, I think an individual who only thinks about himself in those moments, when you're playing in a team sport, you know, you certainly don't want them on your team. It's not the right way to be thinking at that moment. The right way to be thinking about is how can I best serve the team? And that is genuinely, because I'm sure, you know, similar in every environment, that the most important thing is how an individual contributes to the environment you're in. And I do think it's really important that whether it's 1 minute or 79 minutes that you're involved in, that you're doing it for the right purpose. And for that, it's a greater good. You know, like in the Six Nations, it's going for something special and you want to contribute to that and be able to give your best so that hopefully you can get it.
Was it frustrating at times, even with the way certain games developed, where I remember in the Scotland game, for example, you came on at full back and Simon was telling us afterwards like he wanted to kind of see how you could work out there, but just the way the game developed, you hardly got to see any ball back in that position. Were there frustrating times during the campaign?
There's always going to be, you know, frustrating times. And I said it earlier that even when I was getting my first cap at Munster, not getting the enough minutes, you know, at the time was frustrating for me. So, you know, that's just the way it is. And as you go through life, there's many different scenarios that come up that are frustrating for, you know, it might be the fact that it's raining outside when you want to go kicking and it's, you just, I mean, you can't change it and you've just got to learn to adapt and deal with it and what's the best way to operate in that situation. So it's similar to that. It's, you know, like I said, having strong core values and core principles and, you know, catching yourself if you do, you know, start to sway away from them. And it's, you know, for me, it's all about having the wider lens on and understanding everything. And you spoke about patience, and in terms of patience in the environment and whatnot, first of all, it's patience with yourself. You know, you set out as a young fella to go and do something and it's not going to happen straight away. And if you try and tell yourself that it will, You're very far from it. So having patience with yourself and the process is massively important as well.
Is that a learned skill? Was that something you would have been good at when you were 21 years old or 22? Or is that something that now that you're 25 and have a bank of experience that you're much better at dealing with? Just kind of, as we said, like the patience earlier on in the conversation and dealing maybe with little minor setbacks.
There's levels to everything, you know what I mean? You start out a basic job of anything, you kind of go into it and you think you're a class and something comes up and then you go, oh, well, I need to be better because, this is what's required of me now. And that's just the way it is. It's evolution, you know what I mean? It's what keeps you interested, intrigued with the growth and for me, challenges offer the greatest opportunity to kind of, dive a little deeper into yourself. See, do you truly desire what you say you do, and it tests you on every element, and it asks you, are you truly willing to commit to this? And then within that, everything grows. You know what I mean? You have to you understand to do that, you need more patience. You need more patience with yourself and the way in which you navigate obstacles. There's levels to everything, and if you're willing to dedicate to learning and growing, then potential is endless then.
How have yourself, Sam Prendergast and Ciarán Frawley, kind of been dealing with that storm that's kind of seemed to be following the three around over the last few months, where there's this great debate around which one of you should be playing? Like it has got to a point in recent months where there's a perception that if someone praises you, they're throwing out a sly dig at Sam Prendergast or Ciarán Frawley. If someone praises Sam, they're throwing a dig at you and Ciarán as well. How do you kind of keep yourselves on an even keel from and away from that bubble?
Well, I guess that's the main thing is, I think I've spoken about this before in the Autumn Nations, I think. But like when you're in there, I mean, you strip it right back to the most important thing, and it's playing the game of rugby, you know what I mean? And you start growing perspective as you go through your career and understand how to zoom out, like I said, and see things for what they really are, and in terms of, I'd hate if anyone thought that I was putting myself in an individual battle with any other player because it's not going to serve me well. It's not going to serve the team well. It's certainly not going to serve the other individual well. And to make a great environment and a successful environment, you've got to have competitors. And just because we're all competitors and wanting to be in the starting jersey doesn't mean we hate each other at all. You know what I mean? It's potentially the opposite because I think like attracts like, and you know what I mean? I think that's we have such respect for each other as competitors. People that go toe to toe, I think have more respect for each other than anything else. And I know it's difficult, and I appreciate to see from the outside. It's difficult to see that, but that's all it is. And at the end of the day, you're playing in a team, and I know that the team element comes in a lot, but that's truly what it is. And if an individual started playing for himself, I think it would become very clear in the way that he's playing on the pitch as well.
Like attracts like. So you're saying you're all just a bunch of stubborn outhouses at the end of the
Maybe, yeah,
day,
maybe.
is it? back with Munster now and big Interpro last weekend, really, really good result and an exciting trip to La Rochelle this weekend. It looks like you and the other Irish lads have come back in from the Six Nations with loads of confidence, even Craig back from injury and Jean Klein back from injury as well. A lot of things clicked at the weekend. I get the sense you don't have any fear this week. The vibe seems very, very good at the moment.
Well, I said it earlier, you certainly have fear when you're going up against fellas and individuals that they have. I mean, you take one hit from one of them and you'll probably be saying a different thing. It would be far from fear.
I don't have to take those hits. I'm fine.
No, it's there's massive pressure. There's no way to dress it up or dress it down. We want to go far in this competition, and like we always do. And we haven't been happy with where we've gone in the last few years. And look, La Rochelle, they are what they are, and their history speaks for themselves in this competition. So I mean, for us, it's there's a responsibility coming in and delivering in your role and your performance, and hopefully you can lead the group that way.
And just finally then, before I let you go, obviously Ronan O'Gara and the Munster reunion is a big thing as well. He obviously was up to a bit of mind games once the draw was confirmed at the end of January. He mentioned yourself and kind of said your form is a bit yo-yoing. Is that how do you deal with that? Do you just chalk that down to a bit of mind games?
Oh, well, I don't deal in that too much. I guess, you know, the first time I heard of that was really today, from being asked the question. So I suppose from that point of view, it's everybody, and, you know, everybody's entitled to opinion. You know, I could say anything, or we could say anything about any situation. And I guess it's what's great about everything is that you can. And it's something that, you know, like I said, everybody's just trying to grow the game of rugby. It's involved in the game of rugby, and like I've said before, you know, it's for the greater good of rugby. But in that sense, no, I don't take fuel from anything that's said about me or anything, because it only lasts so long. And, you know, if that was the story at this stage, my fuel would be burnt out long ago. So I'm well used to anything that's said, and don't serve much purpose to it.
All right. Well, Jack, it's been a pleasure having you on the RT Rugby podcast, and very best of luck against La Rochelle this weekend.
Thanks very much, Neil. Appreciate it.
Now, turning our attention to the Guinness Women's Six Nations with Hannah O'Connor, as usual. And Sunday was a great day for Ireland. 54-12 winners against Italy. A first win of this year's Six Nations. A first away win for Ireland since 2021 in the Championship. A first 50 points haul in the Six Nations since 2015 as well. And I suppose as well, Hannah, some of those Parma demons put to bed for all of those reasons.
Yes.
A good day at the office for Ireland.
A great day at the office. Yeah, a very comprehensive result for the women's team. And as you said, like, definitely those demons put to bed for sure. Said it's been a couple of dark years going over there, both in Six Nations times 2 years ago, and obviously the big one for the World Cup qualifier, which didn't go as anyone wanted a few years previous to that. So to get over there, somewhere where Italy pride themselves and it beat a bit like a fortress, to be able to go over there and, as you said, cross the 50-point barrier is something to definitely be proud of and something to build up.
On Parma specifically, it's funny because it didn't actually really come up in any of the pre-match media stuff last week. I suppose maybe just one of those narratives that kind of slipped through the cracks, because there was, I suppose, so much to discuss rugby-wise from the match against France the week before. But it obviously was something that was being spoken about a good bit in the team, because I found it really interesting how when Scott was interviewed straight after the match down pitch side on TV, and he was asked about the win, and pretty much the first thing he spoke about how was there was a huge amount of players that had some bad memories in that city and in that stadium as well. And obviously he kind of said, like, you know, I wasn't one of them, but I could see how important all of this was for that team as well. It obviously is interesting to see how teams and coaches and players will always give us the straight bat, I suppose, if we ask about those things. But it goes to show that those conversations are happening a lot inside the team. Those motivations are still there.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing you said at the start, that it didn't come up too much. It just goes to show you that when you're playing good rugby and you actually have the rugby to talk about, that the side shows don't tend to come up as much. But 100%, I'd imagine that it was something there in the back of the minds for the girls throughout the week. That's a place that, as you, we've mentioned there, like, having gone there 2 years ago, and the sheer, like, the way that Italy celebrated beating us 2 years ago there. Last year, getting beaten at home in the RDS in a game that we dominated for 20 minutes and should have really, in every other aspect, dominated the game and still end up on the losing side of it. They've gotten the one up on us in big games over the last couple of years at key moments. And it's just, between home and away, and then between Parma itself being that little place where there's a certain pool of players who definitely would have had bad vibes going there. It is nice to get that monkey off the back in every way. And the emphatic nature of making a statement, you could see how much it meant to the girls up right up until the 82nd minute. That ball is there at the edge. Any other game, you might have the nine just going, pop, thanks a million, we'll take the bonus point win and get out of here. But the emphatic nature of how the girls were like, we're playing, we're making up for lost time here. It's like we owe you one in massive style, and that they did. So that was particularly pleasing to watch, get them right at the end, and how disconsolate is awful, but how broken Italy were at the end, and they're the two contrasting sides. It's nice to have the opposition and have get one over on Italy and pass the baton back to them for a while. So yeah, really, really nice.
We both mentioned it now, but the kind of significance of hitting the 50-point barrier. Mm-hmm. And I suppose in theory it is something fairly frivolous. Like it's kind of just racking, you know, what's the difference between 49 and 51, says you.
Yeah.
But there is something in it. And Scott again said it after the match. He said, like, that was a bit of a statement to do that. And you could see, as you kind of mentioned there as well, to just put the foot down completely. They go 47-12 ahead with, I'm going to say there's 30 or 40 seconds on the clock by the time the restart is taken. Like, would any of us really have cared if they had just caught the ball and kicked it out? I would say no. But the sheer fact that they were determined to just move that ball as quick as they could and just run in that one more try, it said a lot, I suppose, about the mentality and confidence in the team as well. And then the other side of it as well is the quality of the try itself, where Cliona Maloney and Christy Haney firing onto throwing off loads in contact. I mean, I don't know, is Christy Haney right or left-handed? That was some pass off her left.
I know, she particularly like that
tackle
one
as well.
Yeah, she particularly liked that one. But I think, as you said, like, nothing would have been made about it had the game just ended there and then, and it would have been still a very emphatic victory and a comprehensive one. But it was the nature of it. A lot of that group, particularly a lot of the sevens girls, would have been involved and rolled back into 15s for the last time. That was probably their last big involvement, was in the lead up to the World Cup qualifiers. So the last time they played in Italy, in Parma, was that match. So there is a lot of bad blood there for it in terms of the hurt that's there and everything that came after it and everything that's come since it, and the failure to qualify and the downhill slog that's been there for the rest of the group. So yeah, to be able to put the foot on the throat, as you said, and to really make Italy feel it. Yeah, there's no real difference, but there's a psychological edge to it, and there's a lot more venom in it when you're like, when you prove a point and you say, no, we're not actually not finished here. We're going to receive the kickoff, steal it back, and then we're going to go again. But as you said, the two in the middle, Cliona and Christy. Yeah, Christy is right-handed, so that little out the back one that she pulled, she'll be particularly putting that on her highlights reel, so she'll be delighted with that. But it was probably the nicest try of the day in terms of a team move, and to have the slickness of like crisp passing that we talked about last week that was missing. That cohesive nature, that composure, the execution, the confidence was obviously high in the 82nd minute of the game. But yeah, it was great to see it finish in such a flourish.
Yeah, as you said, it probably was the best try of the game. And there was a nice blend to the tries where that was, you know, a lovely team move, lovely slick handling. The two or three, or the three earlier in the second half from Brittany Hogan, Dorothy Wall and Linda Dugan, they were all just grunt, drive it over the line from close range. And then your first half tries was back to a lovely line break, twice from Eve Higgins, lovely line breaks, just getting the ball out wide to Amy Lee and to Anna as well for one of the other ones. To look at those earlier tries though, and you mentioned it, obviously the handling much more slick this week. The handling errors were the big thing that were spoken about post-France. There were 20 plus of them. I can't even remember how many. There were only eight in Parma on Sunday afternoon, which is, I suppose, the most obvious difference between the two performances. Coupled to that as well, striking early when you have the opportunity. Italy get a yellow card inside the opening minute of the game. By the time they're back to 15 players, the score is 14-0.
Yeah, it's a sucker punch, isn't it? And that was the way it really set the tone. Like, Erin King was the one kind of on around, you know, 50 seconds before the game was brought to a halt for that yellow card. She got in there for that turnover off the bat straight away. That sets your tone. Like, you're all of a sudden into the opposition 22 and you're making an entry in there on the back of all of a sudden getting the bonus yellow card that came with it off the initial restart. But the ability, as we talked about there briefly, that composure that was lacking last week for Ireland to sucker punch it and to score a peach of a try through Aoife Dalton off the bat and to make it pay, and then soon followed after, the girls realising that not only were Italy down to 14, they had another player down in the middle of the pitch, and to have the composure, hold the feet, get it wide with a nice, some intricate play with the backs again. I think this week was, as you said, the first half tries, especially, well, the first half in particular, I suppose, were a chance for the backs to shine this week compared to last week when maybe it was a forwards game where those tries came out of. But yeah, to see those lovely kind of link up plays with the backs and show what they're about. Some really fantastic tries, and it just shows that, like, when Ireland are that clinical, they can cut defences open and really put Italy under pressure out wide, and saw the pictures and took advantage of the pictures that Italy were showing them of being that bit narrow and having the gaps kind of in the centres as well. So yeah, it was brilliant. Really well worked stuff and enjoyable rugby to watch as well.
You mentioned seeing the pictures there, actually, and the second try, Anna McGann's first try, was probably the perfect example of that, where over on the near touchline, there's a ball comes loose. Aveen Riley gets down on it first, and I can't even remember who steps in at scrum half, to be totally honest, but they get the ball out. Yeah. And you can almost see the moment they realise Italy are down numbers, it's a turnover ball. There was such a desire to get that moved out as far as Eve Higgins initially, where the overlap was, and all of a sudden the gap is there, and that's where you run it in from. It's, you know, maybe there are other teams where, or I suppose less sophisticated teams, or maybe in previous years, where you secure that turnover ball and there's two or three one out carries to establish the possession before even trying to attempt moving the ball wide.
Yeah, it's that calmness that everybody seemed to be singing off the same hymn sheet, as you said, to identify that that was where the space was and to be able to get the ball to there in a timely fashion before Italy managed to fix the error on it. And that's kind of the big difference that you see. Like last week, we talked about the girls kind of, it was an element, and obviously it wasn't true Emily Lane's fault, but the ball coming to the girls, there was a bit of confusion. And obviously that was the way that we talked about, you know, obviously Scott's Beeman side of attack. It was probably something that she was being told to do, I'm sure, but Aveen Riley at nine this week, I thought made a massive difference to the play. She kept a lovely tempo to it. I thought she, you know, giving the ball quick off the base, and as you said, identifying those moments when the ball just needs to be gone. But the forwards, I thought, holding their feet that bit better and making a bit more gain line. Again, really good high percentages in retention of own ball and retention of kind of high speed ball from the ruck gave Aveen that platform and gave the backs that platform to hold their feet, not getting each other's way, and kind of see those pictures a bit clearer and not having to be forcing things or forcing that last pass. And as you said, showed perfectly there with Eve, was almost like a typical seven try of seeing the gap and turning on the gas and being able to hold the last defender and release Adam McGann. And similar on the other side for Amy Lee's try, you know, the same idea as like exposing the space. There's the space. Let's get it to here. Turn on the gas, give her the ball and let her do the rest, because she's been there before many's an occasion to turn on the gas.
The other positive over the first couple of games, I would say, not just on Sunday, is the depth that we can start to see building around not just the starting 15, but depth beyond that into a bench. And who knows, even maybe beyond the match day 23. It was good to see on Sunday, for example, I know one of them when Linda Dugan was sin-binned, and that's where they made the change when Christy came on. But Neva O'Dowd went off early-ish as well, and they got minutes into Siobhan McCarthy as well, whereas the previous week, the two of them had to go 77 minutes against France. Aoife Wafer even got an early rest, and it doesn't look like that was an injury-related thing. We were all a bit unsure at the time because it was so early to see her coming off.
Yeah.
And then you have the likes of Dorothy Wall, Emily Lane and Brittany Hogan, who had all started against France and I imagine would have been really, really annoyed to be dropping down to the bench on Sunday. All three of them came on in Parma. And I mean, if Scott Beeman wanted a response out of the three of them, he absolutely got that. I would say Dorothy Wall in particular looked determined in her, whatever, 30 plus minutes on the pitch.
Yeah, 100% agree with you. And like, that is what you want. You want that impact off the bench. And it's always what coaches talk about. You talk about your like, you know, you're not talking about your replacements as such, but your finishers or your game changers or whatever you want to call them. But yeah, you could tell, especially in the three that you mentioned, in the likes of Emily, Brittany and Dorothy, there was a definite point to prove there that those three came on with a serious venom. You know, Emily brought great energy to the game from the nine position, because obviously Aveen had a great game as well. So to come on and to add layers to that and to be able to put her own style in it, because they are the nines that are there. Like, you've obviously got Molly Scuffle McCabe as well, who's waiting in the wings, as you talked about. That strength and depth in some positions is, there's an abundance of wealth in some positions, so it's very hard for her not to be making a matchday squad. But the likes of Dorothy now, coming on. I thought she did well last week and was unfortunate not to be included again. But to see her come on with a massive point to prove, I think her try being a real trademark Dorothy, up, win the ball, get involved in the second phase, big carry, make gain line, get up again and you're involved in the next phase and you're scoring off a drive in a position, you're just putting your hand up ready to make a big carry, and that's her bread and butter. So to see her come back and kind of make a statement of like, I want to be back in that starting 15 was great to see. And the same for Brittany Hogan. It's obviously hard, you know, in the position that she's competing with Aoife Wafer for in that back row. And there's abundance of wealth or riches in that back row as well between all of them. And you also have like the likes of Dervin Nicovord, who has come back from injury. And I don't know if they're playing her at hooker or if they're playing her at back row, but another person who's there waiting in the wings for her chance, as well as a few others, young and upcoming talent there that aren't getting into the matchday squad. But to see the likes of Brittany come on and make a huge impact like she did in the same vein as what's been gone before. Great, as you said, to see Siobhan McCarthy get the minutes, because that's the thing, the props, especially not just the props especially, but you need minutes. So like Siobhan and Christie, to get that kind of 20-minute mark of game time is important. It's important to kind of get minutes in their belt, and the same for Cliona Maloney to get reps at line-out time and get personnel changes in there to get everybody ticking. And again, it was another week where the line-out functioned really, really well when the girls came on again, scoring tries off the fact that winning ball cleanly from a line-out and being able to build on it. Brilliant.
And another one, another line-out ruled out as well for, or a try ruled out for a bit of disrupting at the the line-out as well. So they're obviously using it as a weapon. But staying on the depth, and particularly around the back row, scrum half, as you mentioned as well, they obviously have depth at the centre, which we'll get to when we talk about the Dalton maybe in a couple of minutes. But it does, it opens the door for, depending on what the game is, the coaching group can, it's not even necessarily about having a starting 15. It's about picking horses for courses, you know, which of your three back rows are best suited for this occasion. And it's no indictment on a player if they're left out, but it's trying to pick certain individuals' talents to certain individual games.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It'll be interesting to see. I know we touched upon it last week and mentioned, would there be much shuffles in the selection? And of course, there was the three that he decided to twist with. So it's interesting to see, like, obviously you are building up to a World Cup. Are you going to give more people a little bit more of a sample of game time than maybe you ordinarily would in a normal Six Nations year? That remains to be seen. But you do, as I said, you do need that depth. You do need that bit of bite to it. But yeah, is it a case of who's playing or who's training the best, or is it a case of horses for courses? Do you go, especially coming into the likes of England, because England could pick anyone. You know, normally we see England, and we'll probably touch upon them a bit later, but like, they could probably pick three sets of 15, and you don't know who you're going to get. In terms of, you see someone like Abby Burton coming on in their back row who hadn't even been capped before and getting two tries. So it's hard to know. But yeah, for ourselves, it's definitely something that leaves a lot of food for thought. And I'd say it's going to be a busy 2 weeks of training for people to try put their hands up for jerseys leading into a weekend in Cork against the English.
Yeah, very good problem to have. Aoife Dalton was player of the match on Sunday. I do want to talk about her because she was up for media last week, and it was interesting talking to her. She was like, she kind of made the point that she's, I think I was looking at it, she's 22 in about 4 or 5 weeks' time. So she is still incredibly young by international rugby standards, but feels very much part of the furniture now. Sunday was her 20th cap.
And
I put it to her as well, and like, she has seen a lot in those 20 caps. She has been through a lot, and she kind of said that, you know, those experiences, as tough as they were in 2023, have stood to her now.
Yeah, she's probably come in, to be fair to her, like, I can't speak highly enough of a player of like Aoife Dalton in terms of a player and a person. She probably came in the depths of it, you know, get her first cap over in Japan with us, and to say that, like, how she
as deep as a deep end could be. Like, it's the Atlantic Ocean of deep ends.
Yeah, and has taken every bit of it in her stride. Never once has she been in any way flapped or overawed by anything that's gone on. She is the most chilled individual you will meet, and such a diligent professional. Since she's come in to the programme, she has been unbelievable in, you know, just the level of professionalism. You never know that she's as young as she is. The way she carries herself, and you probably have seen her media, she's so softly spoken. She's not one of these players that will be standing in a circle giving a yap for the sake of the coaches to hear that they're giving a good-o. If Aoife speaks, you're going to listen, because she doesn't do it that often. She leads with her examples. I know she said that as well in her media, but it's very true. But I would go as much to say that as a back line, in terms of if you were to put every back out, and even in all the teams I've been lucky enough to play with her in Ireland and in Leinster, Aoife Dalton would be the first name I put in any back line. Such is her pivotal role to the defensive picture. Can't speak highly enough of the work that she does there. The amount of try, save and tackles she would have made in the games over the years for both province, club and country is phenomenal. The work rate that she gets through, it's the dog's work. Like, she gets the limelight there on Sunday, as she rightly should, for her work and her sheer work rate and getting a try to boot as well. But the grunt work that she does, and the amount of work that she gets through, and helping cover up holes that maybe are left by other people, it's great to see her get the kind of the credit that she deserves, because I can't speak highly of someone enough as her most modest, kind of unassuming person you'd meet, and just an absolute warrior then on the pitch. So yeah, delighted for her. Can't speak highly enough of her.
And in line with that point you made about her being modest, she was asked, you know, about her defensive work and how involved she is, and she actually said she wouldn't really think she's much of a natural defender at all. She just she came in and decided, oh, I think that might be an area where I could contribute to. And that has just been the kind of focus since.
Yeah, she's so humble. Like, I'd say I could probably, in all the times that I've played since obviously 2020, whatever, two or three, when we went to Japan, I could say, and in all that time of playing with her at Leinster, I could probably count on one hand the amount of tackles that Aoife has missed. Such is her ability to read a defensive picture and absolutely kill you in the line as well. So yeah, no, she's very, very modest, but a key cog in that. I think everything build that around her. And yeah, there's serious pressure because it's obviously my club mate Enya Breen, who I rate massively, is obviously warming the bench at the moment, which is frustrating for her and another absolute quality player. But again, they bring the three of the ones that are involved at the moment between Eve Higgins, Aoife, and Enya, very, very different players and have different skill sets in terms of a running game, big tackling game, kicking game. So they're so different. So maybe it does come down to, as you said, is it horses for courses in the twist? But yeah, Aoife Dalton, delighted for her to be getting the recognition she deserves.
Well, it's funny, like between herself, Enya, and Eve Higgins as well. Like for the last 8 years, we've been having a debate around the men's team around Bundiaki, Robbie Henshaw, and Gary Ringrose, the kind of three into two situation. It does make me wonder who is who in this Irish women's
No.
trio. Which one's Aoife Dalton? Is she Bundy?
I know, because it was kind of Aoife last year a little bit. She fall, like she was in first game with France, and I know there was a bit of swapping and changing between
There
them as
was, yeah.
well. So it's like, yeah, you wouldn't know what's going to happen, and you wouldn't know what, as I said, Scott Beaman is going to pick. So yeah, I was delighted for her to kind of have such a game that she had, because she's been doing it. She does it every week. With like, I've never, as I said, you rarely see Aoife have a bad game. It's probably just more to the fore if she gets a try, but like, that's kind of up there with her bread and butter in terms of that work rate and the amount of tackles and the amount of work she gets through. So an interesting predicament. But yeah, who's who? I don't know. I don't know who you'd name as who in that situation, but it is a similar little predicament to be in, all right.
And a good one to be in as well.
Yeah.
Also, speaking of like 21-year-olds, Aaron King as well, who again is just continuing to improve week on week in the 15s game. I was looking back on some of the stats she has put up across these opening two games, and I'd love to know what sort of numbers she's logging in terms of like a Bronco score or fitness levels, because there is not a wasted phase in any game when she's involved by the looks of things. So she's taken more lineouts than any other player in the, or no, sorry, she's taken more lineouts than any other Irish player. She's caught 15 lineouts so far. Only Zoe Allcroft has caught more lineouts in the championship so far. So she's pivotally involved in the Irish lineout. She has the most attacking ruck entries for 60 in the entire competition. She has the most defensive ruck entries, 19 in the competition. She has the fourth highest amount of tackles or fourth highest amount of carries with 24. And she has, I think she's 21 tackles, which is inside around the top 10 or so in the competition across two games. Is she just involved in every single phase of play?
It seems to be, doesn't it? She's like massive work rate, but like as I said, she's taken to the adjustment back to the 15s game really, really well. Obviously, the stats speak for themselves. I wouldn't be as familiar with Erin, as I said, we've crossed over. Obviously, she's come back into it now from the sevens game, but obviously, the engine that's provided to you in the sevens and the work rate you have to do of covering the pitch for seven people has definitely stood to her coming across. But she still seems to be able to, as you said, put the same work rate in. And what's interesting is, and you mentioned all those stats, like I saw it kind of been reamed out on the stat reports of like the amount of tackles per person almost in the pack as well. It was very much tit for tat, like high teens, early 20s for a lot of them in terms of made tackles at the weekend, which I suppose goes for two things. It shows you the work rate within people and the trust that's there between everybody to make their own tackles, but also in the system that it isn't just one person. Maybe in years gone by, you'd have one person up there, and probably Niamh Jones being one that would probably be making the lion's share of the tackles in years gone by. But now it's very much kind of a level pattern of everybody kind of within that system making their own hits. But yeah, Erin in particular, her scores and her stats are pretty much off the chart there. But it just shows you the ridiculous kind of stats that you need to be putting up to get into that Irish back row at the moment. It's a bit insane. But yeah, a good complaint again to have.
It is, yeah, and it's funny you mentioned Niamh Jones as well, because that was actually something it was something that popped up last week. She'd done media, and I went back looking through numbers and stuff, and I do remember for two or three Six Nations in a row, it seemed like every week she was making 25 to 30 tackles and was like clear in the Six Nations charts. And it's not a criticism, but it's more she doesn't have to make as many tackles anymore. Everyone else kind of around is chipping in, and there's a broader spread across the forward pack in particular, I suppose, of people making those numbers.
Yeah, I think she's still down for like 21% 20 yeah. or 21
it's
tackles.
Still, it's still a good haul, but
she's still a good haul for knee. But as you said, like the limelight being shone on kind of the others within there kind of takes, I suppose, takes a bit of the shine off her, but she's still doing it. And I said, what's the most important thing, but it alleviates the load a little bit. But yeah, those numbers, like looking at the pack, like you're like talking made tackles, Neve O'Dowd 18, Neve Jones 21, Linda 15, Ruth Campbell 18, and so on. Like their girls are for that, you know, that pack, they're all high teens for what they're doing, which goes to show you the work rate within them and the kind of the drive that's there to slot into that system and, you know, make your hits, because if you don't make your hits, someone on the bench is going to come on and take your place fairly lively. So yeah, definite good complaint to have, but it just shows the system and what they're doing is working. So they'll need it in 2 weeks' time.
We've said a few times so far in this podcast, it's a good complaint to have. We've been very, very positive. We will be a little bit more critical now about one element in particular that I want to bring up, which is around the defence, particularly in the first half. Now, ultimately, Italy weren't good enough on the day to make Ireland pay. And there was a brilliant defensive stand just before halftime.
Yeah.
Neve O'Dowd put in a really, really dominant tackle, shunted them back. Italy get over the line, but I think it was Aoife Duncan Dalton holds them up.
The two of them,
And that was probably the winning of the game to get into halftime and just blow them away after that. But there were a handful of occasions in that first half where Italy just carved Ireland up right through the middle of the pitch. There were three of them off scrums. One of their opening try came off the back of a scrum where they were probably, luckily it stood in the end. It was a funny one. I didn't actually know. I was doing the live blog on Sunday. Did not notice it at the time, but it was only when they pointed out at halftime. Maybe my head was kind of buried in the laptop once I saw this. But I was like, wow, the Italian flanker just kind of broke straight from the back. It was a fairly clear obstruction that should have been pulled back. But anyway, even aside from that, there were a handful of other instances in that opening half where Italy were going right through Ireland in the middle. And it was a mix of poor reads. It was a mix of not guarding around the fringe of rucks
not
as well.
Not completing tackles, leaving
the offload space there as well. If they do that against England, they're going to be in for a really, really long afternoon.
This is the thing, and you said it there. I think it was in the first opening, like obviously those stats we talked about, fantastic, people make a tackle. You're talking like high 80, 90% completion of tackles from everybody, which is what you want, like, and it's great by and large across the board. But yeah, the first 20 minutes watching it and you are a bit like, I don't know if we've covered that. There was a good flow around the ruck to get wide, but no one seemed to be kind of manning that 10 spot a couple of occasions. And there was probably an urgency to have 14 bodies on feet in that line that led to tackle bounce probably quite quickly. And the likes of Rigoni, the likes of Dinka, they love a good release and I'll go again, thank you very much. And as you said, the offloads then that kind of came off that, they lived off scraps, and they did make a couple of occasions where they got, as you said, kind of penetrated through the middle of Ireland and literally kind of ripped up the middle. And I know Scott alluded to the great scramble defense, but you can bet your money that he will be showing those clips as big problems as coming to the England game. England obviously can go through you and will go through you if you let them, but you certainly don't want to be letting them through you. You want to be making them work the harder way to get around you or go over you type thing. But yeah, through the middle, you can't be as porous as that. And if Ireland do that again in 2 weeks' time, they'll be leaking a lot. So it'll be definitely something that they're looking at, because it got Italy a good foothold into the game early, kind of on when the score was probably 14-0-ish and they were looking like they were kind of going to live on scraps. And then the only in, as you talked about, the only other in they got in was for that scrum where they had their opening score off. And interestingly, after, like, I thought Dana had a brilliant game and I was delighted for her that she went so flush off the boot, you know, seamless. It was pure textbook and it was a very much showed like no emotion on her face. It would be typical to Dana, just like clockwork. It was like nothing had ever happened.
And a few on the touchline as well.
Yeah, absolute money ones that she did, and it was just great. And like I said, she kicked. I thought that was a difference maker as well as the composure and the clinicalness. I thought that she kicked brilliantly out of hand as well from the back. That I know I heard Emer Considine talk about it in her comms, that it was that she protected herself a little bit more by going deeper behind the ruck. The pack protected her a bit more in their blocking role. It allowed her to wind up that big left boot, but find grass. So every time she found grass, hang time is huge from her kicks. Find grass and you're earning another 2 seconds while Italy scramble. They scrambled in the first half. She got Mutso, I think, twice in the second half with knocks on. And the only errant kick nearly that she had that went out in the full brought Italy back for that sustained pressure to get the try. But that scrum, the scrum was a funny one because there was a couple of weird calls. And that one, it's funny because Adele McMahon would pride herself on being an absolute menace as a flanker. She'd be doing all sorts of things to her opposite number to try break loose. And like you, I remember seeing that and going, they're surely going to call that back. But it nearly happened so quickly that no one argued it. So they kind of got away with one there that Stefan, but it was a little bit, even with that, as you said, there was an element of some people not knowing who they had sometimes on some defensive read would be something that the girls will look at, especially from the back's point of view out wide, who has who, especially off set piece, because Stefan had a bit of joy there on a couple of occasions scything through. But yeah, the big swinger being that defensive set, as I said, the errant kick brought them back for a line out that they sustained pressure, score at 5:28. Italy look for the world like they're going to score because they're hammering at the line. They're going, going, going. Nivo Dowd with a massive pushback. Mm. She'd be loving that one. And I said, that gives you the energy. Then two phases or three phases later, she's involved with Aoife Dalton and holding up the try, ultimately going into big swing psychologically, if you can hold them out with that big sustained pressure. And that kind of zapped Italy. And then it was kind of Ireland's then to turn on the afterburners after halftime, which they did, which was nice. But yeah, those areas around defence that you talked about, there'll definitely be ones that they will need to tighten up as to what's gone wrong there, that Italy have managed to get through with such ease, kind of through the middle in those opening kind of spurts that they had.
Hmm. Now, they do have time to to really, really look at those things and correct those issues, which I suppose is the positives coming, coming out of this. How are you approaching the game against England? We'll go a little bit more in detail on it next week when we've had a chance to really pore over things. But I suppose, how do you set expectations? How do you set goals for a game like this where, I suppose, predicting, like, going out there and saying we're going to go and try win, it's all well and good saying it, but how realistic is it? What are the parameters that they can set on their approach coming in for these next 2 weeks?
Yeah, it'll be very much tangible goals that the girls can get after. I spoke earlier in the week about it. I said like that the statement and the emphatic nature of a 50 plus win against Italy was very much a statement piece. The girls want to be pushing themselves, the Irish women want to be pushing themselves away from Scotland, Wales and Italy and pushing towards bridging the gap with England and France. To do that, you need to be wiping the floor with the likes of Italy, which they did, to be fair, in many capacities across the pitch on Sunday, which was fantastic to see. In an England game, obviously, different kettle of fish altogether, a different beast that you're up against. We spoke about it a little bit before record. You don't know who you're going to be facing because really England have probably three sets of 15s that they could be putting out in front of you. They like to do a lot of swapping and changing. So in terms of trying to analyse personnel like you could really do with the France because you know what you're up against, you have a bit of a different juggling act to do with prepping for an England because you don't really know who they're going to throw out up until that Thursday or Friday before a game and then you're left to do it. So you're really trying to play against the system that they're putting in front of you, which itself is different to what other teams put in front of you. You normally have a pod of three, like a France would do, like any other team, like Ireland would do, or any other team in any other kind of division would do, of a pod of three forwards off your nine. Whereas England do a pod of four forwards off your nine. So all of a sudden you have a flat four in front of you and a nine like Mo Hunt or the caliber that they have can hit any of the four. So your defensive line all the way out to 50, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 in terms of personnel needs to be on the money or they will cut you up going through you, or they'll give it out the back and they'll cut you up around the corner if you're not connected all the way out to the edge. So yeah, in terms of what the Ireland team will be doing in terms of reviewing it and trying to preview ahead of what they're going to do, for them it'll be the defensive picture. Can they have as close to an 80-minute performance defensively as possible? We saw it with Wales. You switch off, they'll sucker punch you for two or three tries. Ireland will be looking at not having that, which has happened over the last couple of years against them. Can we stay with them for as long as possible? We did it a couple of years ago over there and frustrated them for 40 minutes. How long can we frustrate them for, and how many punches can we land ourselves? The girls showed that when they got the opportunities on Sunday, they took them. We will get opportunities against England, but in the past, we haven't been able to take them. And really sometimes being a bit overwhelmed by it or trying to panic and trying to know that you have few opportunities against them. So I'd like to think that from Sunday, the girls have learned that we can have that composure. We can score when we get the opportunities, but they will need to do that very much so on Saturday or whatever week that they play England. But the defensive thing will be huge. That will be what they're looking at, bridging the gap with. How long can we frustrate them? How long can we hold them out? How many pushbacks can we get against them and drive them back? And basically make England go to a plan B. If their plan A isn't working, what can we do? How many times can we make them try get around us, get over us, get through us? Make them think. Make them not have it freeway traffic like they did, unfortunately, last year against Twickenham. when it wasn't a great day for us. But yeah, that would be, I think, something that they will go after. How much can we frustrate them and take our own shots and chances to crack a few scores on the board as well?
They're a funny enigma, England, because if they weren't there, the Six Nations will be an absolutely incredible tournament, and you know, I'd say wide open, even accounting for France as well. But then the flip side is, if England hadn't been as dominant as they were over the last few years, you're talking about the rising tide that lifts all boats.
Yeah.
Would, if they hadn't done what they have done, would the other unions around the world still be waiting to pull their socks up?
Yes, 100 million bazillion percent. You could bet your life on it they would be. And there is a lot to be said, as much as they're highly irritating to play against and highly annoying, and I wouldn't say I'm a fan of them at all. You got to have nothing but admiration for what they've done. They're a key example, and you're looking at them, and as you said it there, they're the product of what you do when you invest in the women's game. And I know we harped on about it, and I don't like to go on about it too much because it makes it sound like you're bitter about it, but that's the carbon copy of 10 years of investment or plus of a system and investing in the women's game and what you can get out of it, both in terms of the domestic game and their international game.
Mm-hmm.
You see now, Ireland, over the last 2 years, you've invested, you put the right people in place and you put the right coaches in place. Not just putting the girls and kind of throwing contracts out, but you're putting the actual kind of cogs in place to go with all the picture, not just for kind of that superficial level. Then all of a sudden things start to change in the right direction. And look what's happened over the last, not even a year, really, maybe nearly just tipping on a year now for the women's team, and like how exciting it is to watch them, how much excitement it's bringing to people maybe outside of rugby and drawing people in a very exciting year. So yeah, as I said, definitely, I would say 100%, had England not started the movement and be that kind of, as you said, that kind of pinnacle of how to do it, there wouldn't be that moving tide to rise all boats, as you said very well.
Yeah, and like the coattails are now there to be clung onto, because even just looking, climbing ahead towards the World Cup, the ticket sales have already dwarfed what New Zealand did a few years ago, and completely dwarfed what happened in Ireland in 2017. It's going to be by a mile the biggest women's rugby World Cup there's ever been. The game globally, I suppose, is probably in a better place than it's ever been. And this is the year to kind of get these things right, when you are going to be going into having a World Cup in the biggest marketplace for women's rugby in the world.
Yeah, and they, as you said, like, they are doing all the right things. They're putting all the wheels in motion to make it that. They are literally, they've been building for this and waiting for this moment to come around and have their showpiece. They already have a really, probably arguably the, you know, you can't really argue it, I suppose, the top league to play domestic rugby. You have players from all international, you know, kind of countries and divisions coming to play in England. But that's the thing. It's like, what can we take from that in Ireland to kind of start to build our own game? Why not? Like, why, if they can do it, why can't we, you know, steal from them, see what's working, see what's not working, and tweak it to suit ourselves? Like, the sky's the limit. They've shown they've gone from strength to strength. As you said, the growth of the game over the last number of years has led them to this humongous surge in their game, and it's going to be paying dividends in terms of both for the game and economically for their country in every capacity come this September when they roll out the World Cup. I think they're going to do a great job of it, so hopefully they won't win it, but they'll do a great job hosting.
I don't mind who wins the World Cup. If they have an off day next week, I'll be all right either way.
Yeah, we'll take that first. That would be great.
We'll talk a little bit more in depth about them next week. But as always, Hannah, thanks for joining us. A reminder, the Six Nations is on a break week at the moment, but there is rugby on RTE over the next few days. Leinster against Harlequins in the Investec Champions Cup Saturday afternoon from 2:15 p.m. on RTE2 and RTE Player. And you can follow a live blog on the RTE News app as well. And live radio commentary of La Rochelle against Munster, 5:30 kickoff on Saturday Sport on RTE Radio 1. We'll also have updates from Leinster and Harlequins at Croke Park as well. We'll speak to you soon.